The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the Washington College of Law at American University here in Washington, D.C., where we are putting on a program today on a very timely topic, the state secrets privilege. I'm Dan Metcalf, Executive Director of the Collaboration on Government Secrecy here at the Law School, or CGS for short. And we are very pleased that now, just in the beginning of our third year of existence here at the school, we're putting on our ninth program and a series of programs dealing with transparency-related issues. And I probably should mention at the outset that our 10th program will be in January. And I'll hold up our flyer for that. It's going to be on January 20th in particular, which is an easy date to remember. And the title of that will be Transparency in the Obama Administration, a First Year Assessment. And this is designed not only to follow up the program we had here last January, January 29th, when the Obama administration was just 9 days old, but also to be the first in a series of annual assessment programs on January 20th in 2011 and 2012. But today we're here to focus on one particular area of transparency or secrecy as two sides of the same coin, state secrets privilege. And this is something that has been a matter of growing concern to those in the openness in government community or the FOIA requester community or the freedom of information, transparency community, however you like to express it, because it's an area in which there was, shall we say, expansion or extension of the privilege during the 8 years of the previous administration. And when the Obama administration came in on January 20th of this year, there were commensurately high expectations that the use of the privilege, the contour of it, as a evidentiary tool wielded by the Department of Justice on behalf of the executive would be changed, would be, even in the words of many people, reformed. And there has been correspondingly growing concern since January 20th and since some things that have happened this year, such as a Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals argument that was made on February 9th, that things are not changing as quickly or as well as some people would like. And that's primarily why we're here today, to focus on first the state of this privilege, the state of the law today, and then the state of the Obama administration's development of that law, in part perhaps, and then looking on Capitol Hill to see what's happening there and where or how reform, quote-unquote, might come from Congress if the executive branch does not move as far or as quickly as some might like. And then finally, at the end of the day today, or at least before the reception that we have at the very end of the day, we'll have what I call the Blue Sky Panel, where we're gathering a group of experts, really hard thinkers in this area, to consider what the contour of the privilege ought to be. And we're fortunate that we have here, right on the faculty with me at the Washington College of Law, faculty members, as you can tell from your agenda and your handout packages, faculty members who are moderating each of these four panels. In sequence is Professor Amanda Frost and Professor Daniel Marcus and Professor Bill Yeomans and Steve Vladek as well for the last panel. And we're also very, very fortunate that we have in the middle of the day a luncheon presentation by someone who I think I could very safely describe as the premier scholar in this area. I think certainly dozens and hundreds of articles in this area and related areas qualifies Lewis Fisher of the Library of Congress, formerly of the Congressional Research Service, for that distinction. And I don't think anyone either in our audience here today, those of you assembled, or at home, or wherever you're watching this webcast or listening to this podcast, would in the slightest disagree. And Lou Fisher is going to give a presentation that will also ground us in a very scholarly way on the privilege itself. But before all of that, as if that weren't enough, I have the privilege of introducing to you the key member of Congress on this issue. You know, we have it in this forum, most particularly last March, we have made much of the fact that on FOIA issues in general, on the Freedom of Information Act now, for many, many, many years, the key champion has been Senator Patrick Leahy on the Senate side. And I think I can fairly say without risk of contradiction that now in this area, especially or unfortunately, sadly, with the death of Senator Kennedy on the Senate side, there's no question that the key person for this issue is Congressman Jerome Nadler. Congressman Nadler is chairman of the House Judiciary Committee Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties, and that is the subcommittee that originated the most potent bill currently pending in Congress. There are bills now pending both on the House side and the Senate side. But when I say potent, I mean that the bill authored by Congressman Nadler and advanced by Chairman Nadler on the House side has now advanced both through subcommittee and as of just very recently on November 5th, full committee markup, and is poised to move forward in the second session, I think it's fair to say, of this Congress as a very viable state secrets reform bill. And Chairman Nadler will be speaking about that and also speaking about the perhaps relationship between Capitol Hill and the Department of Justice and the White House in this important area, which is a big part of the transparency secrecy landscape. And speaking of that phrase, I want to just briefly mention that as of today, I'm pleased to announce that the Collaboration on Government Secrecy's website, which has an academic compilation of many, many things regarding many, many issues in the transparency area, now has a brand new section on the state secrets privilege. And you see right there on the screen in front of you the introductory paragraphs. The first entry there is a subpage that lists more than 125 State Secrets Act cases that have arisen thus far. And then we have tried to compile every bit of authority and information with links beneath that to serve as sort of a one-stop shopping point, if you will, for anyone who's interested in that issue. And you will see Chairman Nadler's handiwork featured very prominently there. Let me just give you a quick little bit of additional biographical information about Congressman Nadler. He's now in his, I think it's your ninth term. He was elected to Congress in 1992. Prior to that, he was in the New York State Legislature for 16 years. He represents an area of New York that extends from Lower Manhattan, including Ground Zero, into some parts of a county in New York called Kings County. And for those of you who are not from New York, you may otherwise know that as the borough of Brooklyn. And he has been a true champion of a lot of social movement causes during his tenure. And we're very, very pleased that he has become a champion of the state secrets privilege and of considering reform of that, and especially pleased that he has agreed to come here and to share with you his thoughts today. So please join me in welcoming Chairman Jerome Nadler.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you for inviting me to be here this morning. Often when I'm introduced and someone tries to describe my district, which goes from the Upper West Side of Manhattan to the other side of Brooklyn, we like to say that it's a very diverse district. It goes all the way from Nathan's to Zabar's. And in about half the countries you can hear but not hear, people understand the reference. I'm delighted to kick off this program examining the state of the state secrets privilege today. I want to thank Professor Metcalf, the Executive Director of the Americans Collaboration on Government Secrecy, and his student team for all of their work in putting this wonderful program together. The lineup for today features some of the leading experts on this issue and some of the lawyers who have been litigating these cases on both sides in the courts. Many of these individuals have testified before or submitted materials to my subcommittee, and their insights and expertise have helped shape my proposal for reform.
Could you hand me that, please?
Yes.
No, no, the thing under me.
Thank you. Just better this way.
How about this?
No, thanks. Okay. The state secrets privilege is of critical importance, and this program could not come at a better time. There's an ancient maxim in law, which some of you in law school have undoubtedly heard of, that says that there is no right without a remedy. If the government violates your rights, if it wiretaps your phone without a warrant, if it steals your guns for those right-wingers among you, or your papers, if it invades and ransacks your house, if it kidnaps and tortures you, your remedy, the only real way you have to make the rights guaranteed to you by the Bill of Rights, or by the Second or Fourth or Fifth Amendments real, is to sue the government for damages or for an injunction to order a halt to the government's improper or illegal invasion of your rights. If, however, the executive can have any case dismissed on the mere incantation of the magic phrase state secrets without having to prove to a court that the concerns about revelation of sensitive national security information are real, and not simply a ruse to shield embarrassing or illegal acts or information, then you have no remedy and therefore no rights. And the executive can get away with anything in clear violation of the laws or the Constitution, and no one will ever be the wiser. There can be no law, no rights, and no liberty if the executive can do anything it wants behind an impenetrable wall of secrecy. And of course, we all know, while history tells us, that while some executives may be kind and beneficent and law-abiding, one cannot trust that all executives will be. In order for the rule of law to have any meaning, individual liberties and rights must be enforceable in our courts. That is why the state secrets doctrine, as it has been reinvented in the last few years, is, in my opinion, the greatest current threat to liberty in our country. Over the past several years, the state secrets privilege has been raised more often and used more frequently to obtain blanket and early dismissal of entire cases. In every single case challenging the constitutionality of its surveillance and extraordinary rendition programs, for example, the Bush administration argued that the entire subject matter of these cases was a state secret and required dismissal before the plaintiffs had any opportunity for discovery and without any determination as to whether the case might proceed without, in fact, compromising national security. According to an article by one of today's participants, Amanda Frost, quote, the Bush administration sought dismissal in 92% more cases per year than in the previous decade, unquote. Before this, prior administrations took a more surgical approach, mostly using the privilege as it was intended, to limit discovery of specific information, not as a means of seeking outright dismissal of entire cases and evading judicial review of executive actions entirely. President Obama has acknowledged that the state secret privilege is overused, in quote, that's his phrase, overbroad, and needs reform. In late September, Attorney General Holder issued new policies and procedures for invoking the privilege. That policy is a welcome step in the right direction, but it is not enough. While it sets up some internal policing of the use of the privilege by the executive branch, it still permits the executive to be its own judge. This policy does not provide for judicial review of assertions of the state secrets privilege. In addition, before and even after putting this new policy into place, the Obama administration has embraced in actual court cases many of the arguments asserted by its predecessor. In Mohammed versus Jepson, for example, the Obama administration has maintained the Bush administration's sweeping assertion that the very subject matter of the case, which involves rendition to torture, is a state secret and prevents judicial consideration of the case. A three-judge panel of the Ninth Circuit rejected this argument, ultimately concluding that, quote, at this stage in the litigation, we simply cannot prospectively evaluate hypothetical claims of privilege that the government has not yet raised and the district court has not yet considered, close quote. In reaching this conclusion, the panel explained that two strands of the state secrets doctrine have emerged. The first strand, the Totten rule, or the Totten bar, flows from the case called Totten versus United States, in which a spy alleged that President Lincoln, it's a somewhat less recent case, in which a spy alleged that President Lincoln breached a contract to pay him $200 a month for spying on the Confederate Army. In that case, the Supreme Court ruled that the entire subject matter of the case, that is, the existence and terms of a covert espionage agreement, was a state secret and prevented litigation of the case. The second strand of the doctrine flows from U.S. versus Reynolds, a 1953 case involving a lawsuit brought against the government by the widows of civilian engineers who were killed in an Air Force plane crash in 1948. Seeking evidence of government negligence for their lawsuit, the widows requested the accident report of the crash. The government refused to supply the report to the widows or to the courts, arguing that doing so would reveal military information, secret military information, that would harm national security. Relying on a government affidavit and without ever reviewing the accident report itself to see if this was correct, the court determined that there was a danger that the report would reveal military secrets and allowed the government to withhold it. The court, that is, determined that the report would endanger military secrets simply because the government asserted so. The court did not examine it. When the now declassified accident report was discovered through an internet search 50 years later, however, it did not reveal. We then saw that the report did not reveal any secret military information, but did show the government's negligence that caused the crash. Unlike the Totten bar to litigation, which allows dismissal of an entire case based on its subject matter, the Reynolds framework requires the government and the courts to consider the question of privilege on an item-by-item basis. But as in Reynolds, many courts will accept as dispositive the government's assertion of the harm that would be caused by a disclosure without examining the evidence and making that determination for themselves. In Jepson, the Ninth Circuit panel limited the Totten precedent to secret agreements with the government. In so ruling, the panel explained that the Reynolds framework best serves constitutional separation of powers principles. In other words, the court held that outside the question of secret agreements with the government, you could not dismiss a case simply on the assertion that the subject matter was secret. You had to move to withhold specific pieces of evidence on the grounds that those specific pieces of evidence would endanger national security. As the panel recognized, quote, separation of powers concerns take on an especially important role in the context of secret executive conduct, and whatever power the United States Constitution envisions for the executive in the realm of national security, it most assuredly envisions a role for all three branches when individual liberties are at stake, close quote. And again, quote, unlike Totten, the Reynolds framework accommodates these divisions of powers concerns by upholding the president's secrecy interests without categorically immunizing the CIA or its partners from judicial scrutiny, close quote. The panel then sent the case back to the district court to determine what, if any, information should be withheld as privileged and whether, through non-privileged discovery, the case might proceed regardless. The panel did not foreclose the possibility that the case might have to be dismissed once the actual claims of privilege were resolved. It simply refused to do so in the abstract based on the government's assertion that going forward inevitably would require the revelation of state secrets. Rather than allow the district court to proceed in this fashion, however, the Obama administration sought a rehearing before the full Ninth Circuit. That request, unfortunately, has been granted and is now pending. The refusal to return to the district court to prove its privilege claims and the decision instead to press for reversal of the panel's decision is deeply disappointing. So, too, is the recent assertion of the state secret privilege as grounds for dismissing the plaintiff's entire case in Schubert versus Obama, another case challenging the Bush administration's terrorist surveillance program. Schubert was reviewed, the first case reviewed, I believe, under the administration's new policies and procedures for invoking the privilege. The result was the same basic argument for dismissal that we have heard time and again over the past 8 years. Because the government does not believe there is any way to proceed without disclosing state secrets, the case must be dismissed at the outset, so they say. But it is judges not the executive, who must determine whether and how litigation can proceed. As the Supreme Court stated in Reynolds, quote, judicial control over evidence in a case cannot be abdicated to the caprice of executive officers, close quote. And Reynolds itself is a perfect case in point, since the court's failure to review the accident report in that case allowed the government to hide clear evidence of its own negligence behind a spurious claim that state secrets were at risk. It is indeed true that separation of powers concerns are at their highest with regard to secret executive branch conduct, and that the government cannot be allowed to hide between unexamined claims of secrecy. If the government can completely escape judicial scrutiny of its actions by the mere incantation of the words state secrets, then it can do anything, legal or illegal, without effective challenge, and all of our rights and liberties have no protection, regardless of constitutional guarantees or congressional statutes. Our rights and liberties become completely illusory and at the mercy of the executive branch. The state secret privilege must therefore be limited and controlled, and the appropriate balance of power between our three, or among our three branches of government, must be restored in order to safeguard our rights and liberties. That is what my bill and Senator Leahy's companion bill in the Senate seek to do. Congress has already provided guidance to the courts for handling sensitive information in other contexts through the Freedom of Information Act, FOIA, SEPA, I love these acronyms, SEPA, the Classified Information Procedures Act, and FISA. It is high time that we provided similar guidance for handling claims of secrecy in civil cases. SEPA tells us how to handle claims of secrecy in a criminal case context. We need the same statutory guidance for civil cases. Several of the witnesses who submitted testimony to hearings in front of the subcommittee that I chair, the Subcommittee on the Constitution, Civil Rights, and Civil Liberties, including federal judges and former federal judges, the former directors of the FBI and the CIA, and former Republican Congressman Asa Hutchinson, whom President Reagan appointed as a United States attorney and President Bush appointed to as his administrator of the Drug Enforcement Agency, all argued persuasively that the courts have proven themselves fully competent to safeguard sensitive information, and that it is the courts, not the executive branch, that are best qualified to balance the risks of disclosing evidence with the interests of justice. As many of these witnesses also pointed out, while the courts are undoubtedly competent to handle sensitive information, the courts have been overly deferential to executive branch assertions of potential harm, as was the case, for example, in Reynolds. Establishing the proper standard for judicial review, a standard that does not require abject deference to government assertions of harm, but instead ensures meaningful judicial review, is a core goal of legislative reform. My bill, H.R. 984, which has been favorably reported to the House by the Judiciary Committee, provides this much-needed guidance to the courts in the following key ways. First, H.R. 984 prohibits dismissal of a case at the very outset simply on the government's assertion that the case cannot be considered because its entire subject matter is a state secret. Second, the bill adopts the Reynolds framework and requires that all judges, using secure proceedings and other safeguards, review the information that the government seeks to withhold and determine whether the harm identified by the government is in fact likely to occur. In making this independent assessment, the bill directs the courts to weigh government testimony in the same way and along with other expert testimony. This means that courts must consider the witness's background, first-hand knowledge of the subject, access to all relevant facts, and credibility. Necessarily included in this calculus is the government's unique expertise in national security or diplomatic affairs, and its likely superior access to factual information relevant to its claim, facts that undoubtedly will prove persuasive to courts when adequately supported by the factual record. During markup of the bill 2 weeks ago in the Judiciary Committee, the committee considered but did not adopt an amendment to require, quote, due deference, unquote, to government assertions of harm. As I explained in opposing that amendment, requiring automatic deference to the testimony of a witness based on current government affiliation, and let me just say about current government affiliation, it is conceivable that you could have testifying in favor of the government's case that that document must be suppressed, the current director of the CIA. It's also conceivable that you could have testifying on the other side, the immediate past director of the CIA. as a private individual now. But as I said, requiring automatic deference to the testimony of a witness based on current government affiliation alone undermines the goal of independent judicial review and is not necessary because the existing standard, the standard set out in the bill, will result in appropriate respect for government expertise and opinion when it is based, as it should be, on the actual record before the court. A due deference, or as in the Senate bill, substantial weight standard, presumes that the government always testifies and is an objective, disinterested witness, and overlooks the fact that the government may have an interest in withholding information because it is embarrassing, because it reveals misconduct, or because the government or a government official or employee is a party to the case and may otherwise be advantaged if the information is withheld. Thus, while the executive branch has a great deal of specialized knowledge and experience when it comes to evaluating national security interests, it often has other interests in a case, interests that the court has a duty to examine. In Reynolds, for example, protecting the government from embarrassment and civil liability, not protecting national security, was the real reason for withholding the accident report. Similarly, in the Pentagon Papers case, then Solicitor General Irwin Griswold warned the Supreme Court that publication of the study of the United States' involvement in Vietnam would pose a grave and immediate danger to national security. 18 years later, and of course the Pentagon Papers, the court decided the case the other way, the Pentagon Papers were duly published and no national security harm. 18 years later, after Solicitor General Griswold assured the Supreme Court that publication would pose a grave and immediate danger to national security, former Solicitor General Griswold acknowledged that he had never seen, quote, any trace of a threat to the national security, unquote, from the publication of that information, and admitted that with regard to government secrecy claims, quote, the principal concern is not, and I assume he meant in that case, was not, with national security, but rather with governmental embarrassment of one sort or another, close quote. More recently, in Horn versus Huddle, a federal district court judge ruled that the government's use of the state secrets privilege to obtain dismissal of one of the defendants was a fraud on the court. The discovery of this fraud occurred only after the Court of Appeals reversed the district court's dismissal of the entire case. That dismissal had been based on the government's blanket assertion that the entire subject matter of the case, which involves a former DEA employee's claims that former employees of the State Department and CIA unlawfully eavesdropped on his private conversations, the entire subject matter of the case, they claimed, was a state secret. The standard in my bill ensures that all of the government's interests in a case will be examined. It requires the courts to consider government expertise, which often will prove persuasive and should prove persuasive often, based on the factual record that the government presents to the court, but it does not allow either the government or the courts to bypass meaningful judicial review by automatically adjusting the scales in favor of government assertions. Third, if the judge determines that the privilege has been validly asserted, that the documents or information should be suppressed, the bill requires that judges prohibit harmful disclosure of that information and consider whether a non-privileged substitute can be created, a summary, a redacted version, allowing cases to go forward whenever possible while protecting valid state secrets. Where the court determines that there is no possible substitute and that the information is so sensitive that it must not be revealed, that it must not be, that it must be suppressed, H.R. 984 in such a situation allows the judge to issue appropriate orders, including dismissing a claim or finding for or against the party on a factual or legal issue. This provision is modeled on the interests of justice language contained in SEPA and provides judges the same type of flexibility in civil cases as they now have in criminal cases. We all understand the need to protect national security, but both individual justice and national security can and must be protected. H.R. 984 ensures that when the government raises a state secret privilege in civil litigation, the correct balance is struck. The key is that these determinations must be made by the courts, not by the executive alone. All our constitutional traditions tell us that the executive must not be allowed to be its own judge, no matter how beneficent the current executive may be. That is the definition of tyranny, and in this country, we must not have it. I am hopeful that this administration will embrace this balance, and we have been working with the administration to obtain its support. I remain hopeful that they will agree that this is a key priority and that the best way to achieve lasting and meaningful change is through a collaborative effort with Congress. Again, I thank you for inviting me to be with you this morning. I am certain that today's discussion will shed additional light on the state secrets privilege and on the need for legislative reform. I encourage all of you to participate actively in the program. I thank you again and welcome your questions.
Thank you. Chairman Nadler has agreed to accept questions for quite a while this morning, depending upon the depth of your interest. But and if you would come to the microphones on either side of the room, that would be the way to facilitate that. But as people move, and I already see many people moving, I'm going to exercise my prerogative as the conference organizer just to pose a general question. And you may think it's a softball. Perhaps you will not. I don't know. You can be the judge. Because we're here at a law school and we study constitutional law here, or our students do, and several of our moderators, in fact, on today's program teach constitutional law, some people have wondered whether there's any substantial question about a state secrets reform bill being, or law, being constitutional in all respects, given that it does have a tremendous constraining effect on the executive branch. And I guess I should note parenthetically that when the first such bill was introduced in the Senate side, this is by Senator Kennedy and Senator Specter, I think, in the last Congress, it was somewhat remarkable that that introductory material that accompanied that bill even somewhat defensively spoke of the constitutionality and said, oh, by the way, this bill is not unconstitutional or would not be so. I wonder whether that's something that your subcommittee or the House Judiciary Committee has considered and about which you have any concern whatsoever.
Well, with the current Supreme Court, you have to worry about everything, but regardless of precedent. But I don't really have much concern on that question. Even if, as some maintain, let's start at the beginning. The state secrets privilege was first recognized basically as a common law privilege by the Supreme Court in 1953 in the Reynolds case. Some people maintain that it has constitutional underpinnings. Maybe it does. But even if that's the case, there is no question that Congress has the power to regulate evidentiary matters, has the power to regulate in this field. Even certainly no one questions that Congress can regulate the scopes of executive privilege, for example, and other, which does have constitutional underpinnings. No power is absolute, and I can't cite case law on this right now off the top of my head, but I don't think there's much question that Congress can certainly regulate in this area. Legislate in this area.
Gentlemen over on this side of the room.
I'm Bert Wides, representing myself. Your bill deals with what happens when the case goes to court, but as you mentioned, the administration recently with great fanfare announced new standards as to when it would invoke the privilege, and it was hailed as a new, tougher standard. But in light of the fact that, as you indicated in this recent Ninth Circuit case, they've repeated it, and as the officials at Justice Department have told me and others that they ran the old cases where they're continuing Bush's posture on torture, rendition, warrantless wiretapping, that they ran those through the new standard and they qualified, does that give you any qualms about how tough their new tough standard is?
Well, any standard is always going to depend on the people who administer it and how they look at it. I think it misses the point. I mean, it's nice that we have some assurances from the administration that they will be more discriminating in using the in asserting the privilege, that no one person in the department can assert it. There'll be a committee that will have to be personally approved by the Attorney General, that they'll report to Congress. All that is very nice. The key is that it's almost irrelevant in one key sense, and that is that the executive must not be its own judge. All of that says is we'll be more careful in using it. And maybe they will be, hopefully. Although, as you said, if they say that every case would have come out with the same result, then there's no great difference. But even if they would come out with different results, it doesn't mean anything about their successors. You can't trust any executive with that kind of power. That's the point. That's the point of a government of separation of powers. The Ninth Circuit panel said And that's where I get the phrase I keep repeating, the executive must not be its own judge. It's a very cogent phrase, and it summarized a couple hundred years of constitutional law. You can't give the basic problem with the state secrets doctrine, as reinvented by the Bush administration, and is perpetuated here now, it's one thing to have an evidentiary privilege. You can't see that document. You can't see that document because it violates executive privilege, it violates state secret privilege, it violates spousal privilege. It's an evidentiary privilege. And you can litigate on that basis, whatever. That's one doctrine. It's another thing to say that you can't have your case considered because the subject matter of the case inevitably will endanger national security. And have the courts accept that, as some courts have, as the Supreme Court did in Reynolds, without requiring the court to decide whether, in fact, it's factually true. Because that means that you've converted a privilege into a sword. And this sword now says nobody has any rights that can be defended in court. Because all the administration, whatever administration may be, has to do is to say, as I use the phrase in my statement, the magic incantation of the phrase state secrets. And you can hide any conduct, no matter how well-intentioned or how ill-intentioned or how legal or illegal, there is no protection of rights. And if there's no protection of rights, there are no rights. You know, if you read the Soviet Constitution of 1936, it's a very interesting Bill of Rights. Freedom of the press, freedom of association, freedom of this, freedom, as they quaintly put it, of religious and anti-religious propaganda. The only problem was if you tried to assert it, they shot you. So the words on the piece of paper became meaningless. We're not at that stage, thank God, nor anywhere near it. But asserting and maintaining in law a doctrine that says you cannot assert your rights in court if the government chooses to say you can't have a trial because of, they use the phrase state secrets and the court doesn't look beyond that, and that means you have no way of protecting your rights. And the Bill of Rights can become a piece of paper. And that's the fundamental problem here. And no matter if the administration uses that power with restraint or with judgment or not, you cannot allow any executive to have absolute power to do something and then to prevent judicial review of it.
Question on this side of the room, sir.
Steve Aftergood with the Federation of American Scientists. because, as you've explained, the state secrets privilege is such a powerful tool for the executive, I wonder why they would ever voluntarily surrender it. Why would they agree to let the sword be converted back into a mere privilege? And for that reason, I was a little concerned by your remarks at the end that you have a hope and even an expectation that the administration might work with you on the bill. I wonder whether instead it might be possible, some have suggested, to add the State Secrets Protection Act to legislation that the administration wants, such as the Patriot Act renewal provisions. That, to me, makes much more sense as a calculation that they might accept something they don't want if it's packaged with something that they do want.
It's rational.
That's a very complimentary response, especially to someone who's a member of the CGS Advisory Board, as Steve Aftergood is. Can I exercise my prerogative again just to say, is there anything by way of elaboration that you might or is that
secret? The thought has arisen, and I think it's safe to say that the Patriot Act extension may not move more quickly than the State Secrets Act in the House.
But then again, there's always an appropriations bill here or there.
Mm-hmm.
You never know, do you? Question on this side of the room. Yes, ma'am.
Thank you, Dan. This is Danielle Bryan with the Project on Government Oversight. I wanted to thank you, Chairman, for your leadership on this extraordinarily important issue and ask, I guess, a broader question from what Steve was, is what you thought the prospects of passing this legislation are, and what are the roadblocks, and what are the possible opportunities that people in the broader community could be offering to help make it a reality?
It's very difficult to say at this point. Perhaps unfortunately, perhaps not unfortunately, the attention of the leadership in the House and I would imagine the Senate has been very focused on certain high visibility and time-consuming issues like health care. And I think that now that health care is out of the way, at least in the House for the moment, we're going to be able to get some attention of leaders to some other issues. We don't know yet to what extent the administration is going to cooperate with us. We're hopeful. We're working with them. We'll see. We don't know to what extent the House leadership will make this a priority. We'll be talking, you know, and we'll see. It's very difficult to say at this point. I think the only thing one can say really is it's fluid.
Would it be fair to say, Congressman Nadler, with respect to timing, that given that next year is an election year, it's a midterm election year, that for a bill that is by its character basically a second session bill, as this one was, it was introduced in the first session, but moving toward enactment in the second session most likely, that it would be more likely to receive consideration, active consideration, earlier in the year rather than later in the year?
I think that's, I think given where it said, the last month or two of this year and the beginning of next year are more likely than later in the year.
Senator Leahy, when he was here in March, referred to an election year as that silly season and how it was always difficult for him moving legislation through the Senate on FOIA and other transparency matters to do it later rather than earlier.
Depends on the nature of the legislation. Some legislation is easier in an election year. Others, especially if they're complicated, are more difficult. Or if they're complicated or subject to demagogic misinterpretation, are more difficult in an election year.
I know we had, I think, one last question, someone raising a hand in the back row over there. I could just tell that movement there because we're almost at the end of our time, but I think we have room for one more on this side of the auditorium.
Yeah, hi. I was wondering, do you think that the Obama administration is fully aware of the, let's say, growing concern among those that feel that, you know, transparency is maybe being a little bit left behind by this administration in wake of our last administration, or do you feel that that's not the case at all and that they're kind of not cognizant or not as cognizant as they should be because of so many, you know, hot button issues that they're taking on?
I really don't know. I'm not cognizant. I'm not involved in the inner workings of the Obama administration, to put it mildly, so I don't know what their thoughts are. I mean, they're obviously cognizant to some extent. That's why they put out these guidelines, the president. And it wasn't just that they put out the guidelines. The president personally spoke about them. So obviously there's some considerable awareness at the highest levels, to some extent at least. On the other hand, they have, at least in their court actions, not shown any difference at all. To the surprise of some members and some judges even in some of the cases. I think we'll get a better idea of that in the next few months, and I think there may be other people in today's presentation who can better answer that question.
We're hopeful that we can get a better, clearer idea of that even today as the day progresses from one panel to the next. Mm-hmm. And perhaps that can help inform your process on Capitol Hill. But sure, apart from that, you have certainly informed us of how things are on Capitol Hill and shared with us your perspective that has been invaluable. So please help me in thanking Congressman.